Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's M-I-N-T-Z-M-Y-E-R, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live, recording on June 10th, 2021 at about 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We're hosting Flex LNG, CEO Oystein Kolakov. Flex LNG is one of the most modern, homogeneous LNG shipping companies. They are listed both on the Oslo Exchange as well as on the U.S. Exchange. As a reminder, nothing on the call today is going to constitute official company guidance or investment recommendations of any form. I have a long position in FLNG, and keep in mind this is being recorded on June 10th, 2021. So if you're listening to a later recording, just look for those latest disclosures. Oystein, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jay. Good to be back here. I think it's like the fourth time I'm joining your, I wouldn't say show, but at least event. And actually, I do think I have to correct you. We're not one of those who have among the newest fleet. We are definitely the one with the newest fleet. So we just had our last ship delivered the 31st of May, 13 ships. So now we've gone from this investing phase to, as we mentioned in our Q1 presentation, the harvesting phase.
Certainly. Well, you always keep me on my toes, so I apologize for not getting the wording entirely correct. You're right. I think this is the fourth time you've been on one of our interviews, and you know our first one I think was I want to say last January of 2020, and then we talked again last spring, and then we talked again I think last fall, late in 2020, and now here we are, the fourth iteration, June of 2021, and you know, wow, if you know, I hope that folks who joined us on the previous calls and listened to the recordings and the articles and such, I hope they were able to invest in Flex because you know it has been a phenomenal return. I know I bought a lot of shares last summer. Oh man, I don't have the Excel sheet in front of me, but I want to say $4.25 a share last June. And my goodness, here we are, $14-15 a share. So thank you, Oystein, for the great management. But let's pivot a little bit and talk about the LNG markets. What's driving this recovery? I mean, the JKM futures in Asia are higher than I've seen them in, since 2013, probably. What's driving this? And do you think the shipping rates can also stay strong?
Yeah, it's been a hell of a ride. I think, you know, often, you know, I've been an investor myself. I've been sitting and investing both in bonds and stocks. And sometimes when a stock goes quite a lot, you're getting afraid of the height because it's gone so much. But we have to keep in mind, you know, 2018, we raised $300 million. The stock price was at that time 150 kroner, which was equivalent to 70 in $18, and at that time we only had four ships on the water, and we raised $300 million to add another five ships, and so kind of since then, of course, we have built, you know, in-house management, we financed all the ships, so we really, and also additionally recently, the last 2 months, we built a lot of backlog, so we really de-risked the company. So even though the stock plummeted in last year because of COVID scare and everything associated to that, it's still, you know, far below the levels seen in 2018 and also far below book values. So just a reminder here. So talking about gas markets, I sometimes I think you know, we have to start talking about the future, but it's really hard to explain what's happening now if you're not looking a bit back. And of course, we have had, for various reasons, a bit soft market because of two record warm winters in a row. El Nino was one, and then another warm winter. So this has really impacted gas inventory levels. And then, of course, we had COVID, we had the trade war and all this. I don't think I have to go into detail. But so the market was depressed. And then finally, we got a cold winter. And a cold winter coupled with a lot of fiscal and monetary stimulus and has really driven demand, and particularly in Asia, driven by a rapid recovery in China, and where they are firing on every cylinder. So you don't really have to look just to LNG. If you look at Newcastle coal prices, they are at 10-year high now. And steel prices has gone up a lot. Copper price all time. So really, China is coming back, but also not only China, other countries as well. They're doing fiscal stimulus. So that really has resulted in a bounce back in the market. Demand is picking up. We had a graph on this in our Q1 presentation. We had a huge pull from Asia in Q1, which resulted in the highest freight rates and highest product prices ever. You know, we heard cargoes being sold close to $40, and this is equivalent to $200 per barrel of oil. So this pull also means that the ships has to travel further, and that really resulted in a very strong freight market. And this is happening at a time where Europe have had an incredibly long and cold winter, and inventory levels are at very low levels. So really what, you know, Europe would have to do was to buy a lot of LNG to push this on into their inventories in order to restock. But Europe has not been able to do this because Asian demand has been strong. And not only Asian demand, we also seen very strong demand from Latin America. I think we first saw it with Argentina because of low capex in Vaca Muerta areas. Argentinian gas, domestic gas production been low, so they have really had to source a lot of gas. And now that Argentina has done that, now Brazil is also coming in, because a La Nina usually means that the season will be dry in South America. I worked with sugarcane ethanol in Brazil before, so I really know that. I really felt this hard on my body that La Nina can result in a very dry agriculture environment. And this has happened in Brazil as well now. So they are also sourcing and competing head on head with Europe for LNG. So everybody wants LNG. And LNG prices now are $12 in Asia. They're $10 in Europe. Last year, Asian LNG prices were all the way down to less than $2 and even broke $1 in Europe. So it's an entirely different market. It's very strong demand. And Europe really needs to restock. And I don't think Europe will be able to restock ahead of the winter. So it could very well be a volatile winter this season as well, which is generally good for freight demand.
Yes, certainly a lot of stuff going on, and a huge pivot from, as you mentioned, two or three winters, which were very mild, which is good for the folks who live in Asia, but is not necessarily good for investors in LNG tonnage. So now we have the very frigid winter, and you know, the weather forecasts are, you know, it's all speculative at this point, but usually we see two of those in a row. So we're thinking we might see another cold winter coming up ahead. With these higher Asian LNG prices, I know that this benefits your modern fleet, right? Because it's more efficient. So what's the current spread between your modern Megi and XDF vessels and the tri-fuel equivalents? How much in dollars per day should we expect?
Yeah, you're right. Of course, just for those who are unfamiliar to LNG shipping, so it's a bit different than other type of shipping, because we are consuming part of the cargo as fuel. So our LNG tanker has something we call a boil-off, because we're keeping this at minus 163 degrees or 260 Fahrenheit. And of course, the thermos is not perfect, which it doesn't really need to be. So we take out some of this boil-off vapor and we use it as fuel. And it's a much better fuel than than using diesel or marine gas oil because it's cleaner and it's already on the ship. But this means that the newer, more advanced ship, which has like a fuel advantage of when you're taking into account the parcel size, 60% more fuel efficient than the steamships 10 years ago. It means that if a charter take one of our ships, they have more cargo to sell. And at these prices, that's, of course, an attractive proposition to have more cargo to sell. So this premium compared to the tri-fuel ships, usually we compare it to the tri-fuel ships. So there are three different types of ships. It's the steamships, the older type of ships, 200 of those, 160 tri-fuel ships. This is a diesel electric and then the new type. And there are some other ships as well. But the current quotation, I checked it up today, Affinity on Friday were quoting 20,000 premium on a Megi XDF compared to a tri-fuel. And Clarkson's on Friday were at 13,000 to 20,000 per day, really depending on whether the ship is trading Atlantic or Pacific. You usually get a better premium for long haul. So I would say somewhere around 15,000 to 20,000 premium on a modern XDF Megi compared to a tri-fuel. And of course, the higher the LNG price, the higher this premium will be. But that's not the only point. Another point is the fact that charters are stepping up the parcel size. So some of the charters, especially those sourcing cargoes from US, they really want to have a big ship to take the big parcel, and they might very well be willing to pay more.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. And I think it's just important to understand, both for people on the call today and investors later, that, you know, the conventional quote that we see in the market for LNG spot rates is normally tri-fuel. I know some of the brokers now are providing both quotes. One of the charts that we have on our service is the tri-fuel rates. So if you're seeing those TFDE levels, those benchmark levels, you have to add 15 to 20,000 to get an equivalent spot rate for your ships. So you fixed a lot of your vessels on charters. You have a lot of them now with solid term cover, and the market has loved it. I mean, the market has really liked that strategy. But are you kind of fully maxed out on charter cover, and you're going to keep the rest on spot, or do you think there's some more appetite for charters?
Yeah. So right now, as we guided on in our Q1 presentation, we really just have one ship really free and open in the spot market. So of course, our preference would be to fix ships coming open in 2022. Of course, you know, price is the main determinant. So if somebody put a lot of money on the table, sure, we would probably let the spot ship Flex Volunteer go. But our main focus is to fix ships coming open in 2022. And we just recently demonstrated our ability to do that in end of May, just ahead of our Q1 report. We announced that we have fixed Flex Freedom, which is coming open in Q1 next year. We fixed her with a portfolio player for a minimum period of 3 to 5 years, and this period will be declared in Q3. So I would say our preference would be to fix ships coming open in 2022. But that said, you know, we don't really have that many ships coming open in 2022 because we have fixed 6 to 7 ships just the last 2 months on I would say 3 to 5 year time charters.
Certainly. It's a more stable platform, I think. You know, it's always been a smooth platform with your, you know, long-term bank financing and modern vessels, but it's a much more predictable cash flow platform now that you have some of those charters out there. So I think that's why the market is very enthusiastic about those. Now that you've delivered your final ship, you have 13 vessels on the water. Is there any appetite or opportunity to grow the fleet at this point, either via like a secondhand purchase of modern tonnage or some sort of new build charter? Is there anything that's attractive out there right now?
Wall Street Journal had a report this week, I believe, about the flurry of container ship newbuilding orders. And as I touched upon in the introduction, steel prices gone banana. So for a regular big cargo ship, the price is up around $15 million just the last couple of of months. So new building prices are picking up. I think new building prices are getting to $200 million now. They are at around $200 million, and that is for delivery in 2024. So this price increase of $15 million, if you know, we have 30 new brand new ships on the water, just for all ships on the water, that translate into an increase in what you call the NAV, or net asset value, of $3.50 per share. But still, our book value is around $16, and that's on much lower capex per ship than the prices are today. And our stock is trading at like $14.50. So it's not really, I believe, in interest for shareholders here to invest in ships costing $200 million when I believe rough calculations here. Our implicit pricing is like $170 million per ship. Those ships are on the water. They have backlog, they have finance, they have software around it. While the new building price is $200, and that ship is only available in 2024. And you have to tie up all that money into 2024. So if you're taking into most investors, they care about cost of capital. So a $200 million new building delivered in 2024, when you add on supervision, it's like $215 million. So it's a really a big difference in what we see in replacement capex compared to what the stock is trading at. So that's why we've been buying back stocks. And that's why we are today the fifth biggest shareholder, at least in Oslo, of our stocks, owning 1.5% of the company, because we have felt that this disconnect in pricing between our value of our ships and what we see of replacement capex doesn't make sense. And that's why we bought back 800,000 stocks at 865. And we just recently hiked the buyback threshold. And so our preference are to pay dividends and buy back stock at least as long as we see this disconnect between replacement capex and where we are trading at.
Yeah, certainly makes sense that it makes sense to invest in your own company, in your own stock. And as investors, we just wish that more shipping companies could figure out that basic math. And, you know, we're glad you figured it out. So, you know, I've ran some new build parity calculations on Flex LNG, and I get to a share valuation, you know, if your fleet was valued what I think would be correctly, which is new build parity, north of $20 a share, right? But your current share repurchase authorization, if I recall correctly, is $14. Do you think there's any appetite to move that a little bit higher, considering, I mean, that's a pretty big gap, right, between 14 and 20. Is there any appetite to move that up a little bit?
Yeah, we've been moving it every quarter. So when we started up in November, you know, we started paying dividends in November 2019, and then we continued in February 2020. Keep in mind, we were in an investment phase, so we had some capex, so we had to be a bit stingy on the dividends given the capex commitments, and we also had some ships not being financed at that time. And then given all the uncertainty with the COVID, we discontinued the dividend for two quarters, and then we reinstated it. And when we saw that in Q2, Q3, even though things were pretty difficult, we managed to trade those two quarters at a time charter equivalent earnings of $47,000, both those two quarters. So cash break even today is around $45,000. And we ended up 2020 time charter equivalent earnings of $60,000 per day, even though we had very high spot exposure. So we started off then with our buyback at $10. We increased it to $12, and then we increased it to $14 in May. I don't really think a company should be buying back its stocks forever. I think buying or paying out dividends, it gives more discipline to management than buying back the stock, because, you know, if you buy back the stocks, you increase your EPS and you look good. But, you know, if you are in shipping, you should really get some dividend stream. So I wouldn't say, you know, we might increase it again, but right now we decided to increase it from 12 to 14 and rather prioritize paying dividends. So we also hiked our dividends to to 40 cents for Q1. In Q1, our adjusted EPS was 64 cents. Usually, our adjusted numbers are lower than now higher than the regular numbers, but actually our official EPS was 88 cents for Q1. But we had some gains on derivatives, so we don't take those into account when deciding on dividends. So 64 cents, we paid out 40 cents, and you might think, why not more? And this was due to us buying back 10 cents worth of stocks during that quarter. And then we also have CapEx for those last three deliveries we have had in the first half of 2021. So I think for us, it's more focus on dividends than buybacks, but again, you know, we are open to buy back more stocks, certainly.
That's a very balanced approach, and I liked to see the repurchases last fall. You know, it's always good to do more when there's a valuation disconnect, but nobody's going to complain about a good dividend. And, you know, 40 cents is robust. It's an 11% yield as of today's trading prices. It's a variable dividend, right? So it's based on the earnings and so forth. However, you also had a slide in your last presentation that kind of showed the potential earnings for next quarter. For Q3 and Q4 as well. It looks like next quarter might be a little bit sequentially lower. Q3 is similar to Q1, and in Q4, it looks like it's going to be probably much higher than Q1. So should we think about that 40 cents? I know it's variable, but should we think about that as fairly stable, as something that can be maintained? Is there any sort of upside potential? How should investors think about that dividend?
Yeah, so Q2 is traditionally and usually the weakest quarter. This is because you're coming out of the winter and you're going into the summer. So it's spring and it's shoulder month. And also, most ships are delivered early in the year. It's like when you buy a new car and you want to have the brand new model. And it's a bit similar with ships. So if you have an option of taking delivery of a ship in December, you rather take delivery in January to get the right vintage. So that really means that new buildings are skewed to the beginning of the year, and once these ships comes into the market and demand is a bit lower as well, Q2 tend to be weaker, and then it picks up in Q3, and Q4 is usually the best quarter. So we didn't really raise the dividend to 40 cents just to reduce it in Q2. As I mentioned, we generated 64 cents in Q1, so of course Q2 will be a bit weaker, but then we have also guided on revenues for Q3 and Q4, where they will be bouncing back to Q3 levels, in Q3 to Q1 levels, and then even higher revenues. We expect to go to closer to 100 million in Q4. So we really do have then more ability to pay higher dividends, and also we don't have any more CapEx drag. Additionally, we, as you mentioned also, we have all the ships financed. First maturity of our loan is second half of 2024, and we are sitting on a cash pile of $139 million. So we don't have any plan of decreasing the dividend. If anything, I think everybody with a PhD from Harvard can calculate that there's probably more upside room on the dividend than downside.
Well, you know, admission standards are slipping these days, so don't set the bar too high these days. Oh, man. So what's something that, you know, the LNG market's very strong right now. It's much improved year over year. We talked about why. What are the primary risks to this market? What should investors be watching out for? What is something that concerns you about maybe next year or the year after?
I think it's always like Donald Rumsfeld said, the unknown unknowns. I think what is probably not unknown today is like the COVID. Are we getting into more mutations, and are the vaccines really coping with changes in the mutation? I think that's the biggest risk, and the new lockdowns. Even though gas is much more resilient to these lockdowns than oil, so oil, you know, OPEC in Russia cut oil output last year by 9.7 million barrels. LNG was growing last year, 1%, even though that was softer. So I think COVID, the uncertainty about COVID is in the shorter term, the biggest risk. The order book is visible. If you order ships today, you get them in 24. So we don't really see any big surprises there. You could have the risk of supply outages, that some big train is going down, but this doesn't necessarily need to be negative. So we have had supply disruptions in Australia for Gorgon. Gorgon is one of the biggest LNG plants in the world, 15.6 million tons annual production, and they have three trains, and they have taken down one of these train in sequence. So suddenly you're losing 5.2 million tons. And then these inspections and repairs are going on for 4 months. But with the Gorgon plants going down and it's less supply, I think in general, that's been positive for the LNG market because those volumes are very close to the end consumers. So consumers in South Korea and Japan, they have had to source that gas from, let's say, US instead. And then the sailing distance there is much longer. So supply outages doesn't need to be negative for the freight market. So, yeah, I would say main concern is mutations of COVID in the short term.
Makes sense. So we're looking out for this kind of broad macro factors, both in terms of COVID and also, of course, I would suppose global economic growth, Asian consumption, those sort of things. Which, of course, we've been tracking for years.
Yeah, I'm not that worried about it. There's so much fiscal stimulus, even if Biden's infrastructure plan is cut by half. It's just so much money flowing around and liquidity and fiscal and monetary stimulus, and ECB kept the interest rate at zero. So I'm not really concerned about fiscal trust. I think it's more related to the COVID.
Okay, that makes sense from your perspective, and something, of course, we'll have to keep watching. And hopefully that's mostly a rear view item at this point. But you're right, there's unknown variants circling around out there. And the vaccination rollout has been very successful in the United States. Europe is kind of, I guess, next in line. But there's a lot to be accomplished and a lot to be desired in parts of Asia, Africa, Latin America. So hopefully we can get the vaccinations ahead of the virus there.
Yeah, but if you are nihilistic about it, I'm not saying you should be, but if you are nihilistic about it, what matters for LNG demand is Asia, 75% of the market, and Europe, like 20% of the market. And what happens rest of the world is not that doesn't really make that much sense to matter to LNG freight demand.
Right. This isn't a COVID-19 interview. It's a Flex LNG shipping interview. So yeah, definitely for investors and traders, focus on the regions that matter for this market, which of course are primarily Asia and then secondarily Europe. So, looking ahead a little bit to more regulations and potential risk or benefits from these regulations, there's the 2023 EEXI regulations that come into effect. There's also proposed large taxes on bunker fuel. Of course, your ships don't burn bunker fuel, but those are kind of the two big shipping proposals out there. How does that impact Flex? Is that a risk? Is there some benefits to that? What are you doing to position yourselves for it?
No, I when we invested in the ships, it was, our biggest shareholder, John Fredriksen, who is also the biggest shareholder of Frontline, Golden Ocean, SFL, and Avance Gas, and a lot of other listed companies. He founded Golar and sold out of them in 2014, and then we went into LNG again. And the reason for doing this was this big technological change where the new ships are just massively more efficient than the older ships. And there is a lot of older ships because attrition age historically has been 40 years for LNG ships. So it's really due for a wave of retirement of older ships. And so this upcoming EEXI or the MEPC 76, which they are discussing this month, we really see this as a golden opportunity to get rid of a lot of competition. And the more stringent the rules are, generally, the more favorable it is for us because the attrition of older ships will go quicker. You mentioned this carbon tax on bunkers fuel. I know Maersk was out saying $150 on a CO2 equivalent basis on bunkers fuel. I I think it's a bit crazy for a shipping company to go out with that kind of announcement. Shipping is by far the most efficient way to transport goods, much more efficient than rail, road, plane. So you can't really just implement $150 per ton of CO2 equivalent for shipping. If that's the case, then it should be like $1,000 for planes, higher for rail. So you can't really find just a solution for shipping. You need to find a global cooperation and price of CO2 tax. You can't really just single out some industries. If you are putting $150 of CO2 price for the cement industry, you can just close down the cement industry. Because every ton of cement you're producing 2 tons of CO2. So I don't really believe in finding those kind of sector-specific solutions. I believe we need to find a global price of CO2, and it shouldn't be a cap and trade. It should be a tax. Government can use that to stimulate or tax break or whatever they want to do, but we need to find a global tax on CO2. And those countries not willing to participate, then just give them a carbon border tax adjustment. So if, let's say, China or India, they don't want to participate, well, okay, every time they are exporting goods, then those goods are being taxed at the border. I think more global solutions. We can't really find just everybody has a patchwork of different rules, and we end up with a spaghetti of rules. So, but in general, regardless of that, we more stringent rules on decarbonization is definitely good for us, because we have the most efficient ships, and we have done this investment because we believe that a lot of these older ships are due for retirement.
Certainly. I'm glad. I don't want to get too much off onto a rabbit trail, but I'm glad you mentioned the aspect of the global regulation and the aspect on carbon overall and oil prices and coal and that sort of market overall. And, you know, I imagine that, you know, if we really want to take climate change globally seriously, there needs to be a massive tax on coal, right? There needs to be a tax on natural gas. There needs to be a tax on crude oil. And I imagine that would completely put coal out of the business too, which would be good for LNG transport. So there's just so many moving parts and so many dynamics. And I think you're right that it doesn't really make sense to have, as you called it, a spaghetti of regulations. So hopefully, you know, more rational minds will prevail as these regulations get rolled out. Hopefully we'll focus on a, you know, UN-led IMO type proposition, as opposed to, you know, 10 different regions doing 10 different things. But, you know, it's early and it's something we'll keep watching. And I'm glad that Flex is positioned with the most efficient tonnage. I did have one question from a person in the chat. It's kind of a sophisticated question, but hopefully maybe you can address it. There's been a new design in LNG engines. It's called a MEGA, like mega, which meets like a higher level of emissions requirements without need for specific upgrades. How does that compare to the MEGI engines that Flex has? Is there any sort of difference between those?
Yeah, it's a good question. And but just before answering that, I can't help myself. I have to tell you, because if you're talking about CO2 tax on coal, if you start taxing, you can't really stop with CO2. So if you're starting taxing coal, then you should also be taxing SOx emissions, NOx emissions, particulate matter emissions, which is all this fine dust, which really is bad for your health, the mercury emissions, all this you need to tax then. And I think, you know, you should do that. And of course, reason why America and Europe has been getting out of coal is it's not really CO2 emissions. It's all these local air pollutions, which are terrible for your health. And that's why also China have had their Blue Sky initiative and ramped up LNG a lot the last 5-6 years. And I do think China will become the biggest LNG importer in the world in 2021. And then the technical question, the mega engine. So maybe I can explain this. The mega engine, if you look at the main engine of a MEGI engine, a ship with a MEGI engine, our XDF engine, and this new mega engine, they are all the same. The engines is a slow speed two-stroke engine which can be fueled by marine diesel or marine gas oil and LNG. So it's a dual fuel engine. So the engine is the same. The only difference with these three type of different engines are the fuel gas system. So there are two vendors. It's MAN, which is owned by the Volkswagen Group, and then it's WinGD, which used to be Wärtsilä, which is bought by the Chinese. They are making the XDF engine. So the engines are the same. The difference is how you handle the boil off. So the boil off comes from the tanks, and you need to put this boil off into the engine. And under a MEGI system, what you are doing is that you are putting the natural gas vapor into a high pressure compressor, which push the pressure into through a five stage compressor up to 300 bar. So this, and then you put the boil off gas into the combustion chamber of the engine, and you know, given this high pressure, you have a fantastically good combustion. It's very clean, and you don't have methane emissions. The only drawback is these compressors are expensive. They cost about $6 million. We have 9 mega ships. On 3 or 4 mega ships, we even have a full relic system. So we have 2 compressors. So then you're spending like $10 million on the compressors. But this gives you the redundancy of relic and this clean combustion. But it's a lot of money to spend. So WinGD, which is making the XDF, they have a simpler solution. Rather than going through making this pressure, we just put it at a cappuccino pressure of 15 bar and we put it into the engine, and we save a lot of money on this fuel gas system. And you can rather do it at a lower pressure and save some capex and also some opex. But the drawback, you get slightly poorer combustion, so you have more methane slip, so and slightly higher fuel consumption. So a lot of people has been opting for the XDF. We also have 4 XDF ships in our fleet because of lower capex and opex. And then MAN, which makes the MEGI engine, have introduced the MEGI engine as an alternative to the MEGI engine, which basically is the same as a XDF. It's lower pressure combustion in us with a simpler fuel gas system, and it's really about saving capex. And then you have to make a calculation. Are you willing to have slightly lower kind of combustion in order to save some capex? And that's really what people are evaluating. And I think the MEGI engine is very similar to the XDF.
Yeah, thanks so much. And I appreciate you dive into that and talking about some of the more, you know, scientific specifics. You know, we're kind of looking at the small details, but that's important, right, for investors to understand how this technology works and what's going on here. I think the biggest takeaway that and you've always done a good job of communicating this, but the biggest takeaway is that your vessels will generate anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 per day more than the next best, which is the tri-fuel. And the tri-fuel generates, you know, $15,000 to $20,000 more than the steamer vessels. So you have this significant step function in the global fleet. And I think that's the big picture takeaway. And then the smaller granular details, you know, scientific stuff is good as well. So I appreciate, I think we hit both ends of it. One of the biggest risks that folks talk about is in shipping is always the order book. We always watch the order books. And the LNG order book's been large for a while, but the long-term macro perspective has also been very bullish. However, Qatar reportedly, right, and we've been talking about this, what, for 2 or 3 years now, but Qatar is trying to order up to 100 new LNG vessels. Can we talk about that a little bit? Does that pose a risk to the global trading system? And when do you expect to see these deliveries hit the water?
I think probably they will order more than 100 ships eventually. I would expect them to do a tranche of ships this autumn. And of course, there are very good reasons for them doing this. They have a huge expansion project. I do think US will probably become the biggest LNG exporter in the world around 2023, 24, 25. Those years, and of course the Qatari don't really want to sit idle and see this happening, so they are expanding massively, and they will be expanding their capacity from 77 million tons to 100 and 10 million tons, and then they're planning to increase it to 126 million tons. So all this new capacity, then you need new ships to carry. So it's not really the Qatari, it's not really going into the market to order ships on speculative basis in order to destroy the market. They are ordering these ships in order to have ships to transport the cargoes they need. So if you look at the first tranche of ships, which is the first expansion, which is 33 million tons, they probably need around 45 to 50 ships for these volumes. And then they also have Qatar and Exxon has this project in the US, Golden Pass, which is 13 million. 15 million tons. So they probably need, because it's a longer sailing distance, around 25 ships for that project. So if you're adding 45 ships for the first expansion in Qatar and 25 for Golden Pass, you get to 70 ships. And then the Qataris also have 25 steamships in their current fleet, which they probably want to retire once they're getting off contracts. So that's another 25 ships. But then they have another 16 million volumes, tons of volumes, translating into at least 20 ships. And then there is this big X factor, which we don't really know about yet. And they have 45 Q-Max and Q-Flex ships. These are big ships, 216 to 266,000 cubic. So these ships are a bit peculiar in LNG industry because they don't burn LNG. This was when LNG price, these ships were built when LNG prices were very high and heavy fuel oil was an alternative fuel, which was very cheap. So instead of burning premium LNG, they decided to make some ships which can burn heavy fuel oil and where you re-lick all the boil off. There are some drawbacks here because after IMO 2020, they can't burn heavy fuel oil anymore, so they have to buy a more expensive premium marine diesel. And then also you consume a lot of power by doing re-lick of all the boil off. So the long, you know, how long these ships will be trading is a bit uncertain. These ships will have a big penalty on the EEXI rules because you automatically get a 25% penalty by burning marine diesel instead of LNG because of higher CO2 emissions. So I actually do think Qatari will eventually order more than 100 ships, but I don't really worry too much about it because these are for new volumes and replacement of older steamships.
So it's a very strategic industrial sort of mix between, you know, in-house sponsored projects and sort of fleet renewal then. So at the same token then, we can't really include Qatari Megatrain, we can't include Golden Pass, we can't include those on the demand side either, right? So it's like it's kind of separate from the rest of the global picture. Is that fair?
Yeah, this is a bit like we have had some graphs on this and or slides, and this is a bit LNG 1.0, which I've been talking about for now close to 4 years, where you are signing up a lot of volumes, it's long-term offtake agreements, and you are doing time charters long-term, probably 15 to 20 years. You get the volumes, you ship the volumes, and everything is back-to-back and fairly point-to-point. And the Qatari has been buying up a lot of capacity in Europe on the regasification side in order to be able also to ship volumes to Europe, because Europe is the sinkhole in the LNG space. If there's not demand other places like Asia, Europe has a huge capacity to take on volumes because Europe has a lot of LNG infrastructure, and then also they have huge gas storage levels, and the gas storage levels in Europe is 100 million BCM, which translate into like 70 million tons of LNG, and this is similar to the US production we expect this year. So Europe can basically take all the US production this year and put it on storage, which gives them a lot of flexibility, and that's why also Qataris are buying capacity in Europe. So I think this is a more industrial-driven project rather than some other projects we are seeing.
Yeah, that's important to understand. I guess my point to make for investors and stuff is that, you know, we can consider that the supply growth from the Qataris is siloed. However, we also have to make sure that we're considering that the demand growth from their projects is also siloed. You can't have it both ways. You can't point to Golden Pass as a good thing for demand and then also try to offset the shifts that are associated. So I think if we just split the global picture in two parts, as you've done, I think that's fair. Qatar isn't going to do this with their own financing, right? They're going to find partners. They're going to sign up for the new building slots themselves, but they're going to partner with shipping companies to finance this and lock in long-term. Maybe it's 10, 15, 20-year time charters. Is this of any interest to Flex? Do you have any desire to participate in one of those tenders, or are you staying out of that market entirely?
Now, of course, we have been invited, and we look into it, and it's a long process, and we will know whenever they are ready to do something. So maybe. But again, we need to get a sufficient return on our capital if we are employing capital. We always have the alternative of paying dividends or kind of plowing back capital and investing. And if we don't meet the hurdle, then we rather pay dividends.
Certainly makes sense. I think investors would much prefer to see the focus on the quality fleet that you have today and dividends as opposed to any sort of growth for the sake of growth. And I know you haven't done that at Flex. I know that's not John Fredrickson does not do that. That's not his playbook. But unfortunately, there are some other shipping companies which have in the past pursued growth just for the sake of growth. And I think we can see what's happened to some of those stock prices of some of your peers that have went down that bad route.
I really have to be convinced. I'm also a shareholder, and if I'm giving away dividend capacity, I really need to see some really good prospects for that investment. Our biggest shareholder, he feels the same way, I can assure you.
Excellent. Yeah, the ship on the water today is worth two and two on the water tomorrow, right? So let's keep it going. So one kind of technical question before we wrap up here. I had a question from one of the readers. It's a technical one, but it's a good one. I'm asking about one of your swaps. You have interest rate swaps on almost all of your financing. You recently sold one of those and changed it out a little bit to a lesser value swap. Was there any sort of strategic long-term view on that with interest rates, or what was the thinking behind that?
Okay, it's a very good question, and it's a very detailed question, and I'm happy to answer it. I think I was on your program last spring, and if you remember, we reported our Q4 numbers in the end of February last year, and we also had an investor day, and then the COVID hit, and we just secured financing for 5 ships at a margin, let's say we are low 200 on the margins generally for bank financings. But then when the COVID hit, we had a lot of anxious investors talking about, well, you financed your 5 2020 new buildings. We ended up taking 4 new buildings in 2020 because we slipped one of them into 2021, and we actually took delivery of that ship 1st of January 2021. And this goes back to this with the vintage, as I mentioned earlier. But then a lot of investors said, well, you have financed those 5 2020 ships, but what about you 2 21 ships? Are you not going to finance those ships as well? And so we went out in the banking market March, April 2020, when the world was on fire in terms of the COVID. But I think it also demonstrated our very good access to capital. When we reported our Q1 numbers in May, we had financed both of our 2021 ships in probably one of the most challenging credit markets around, at least as challenging as the financial crisis, when I was also a CFO of a company at that time. Despite also the freight market being terribly weak at that time. But in order to get those ships financed, we financed Flex Volunteer And the margin we paid, we have reported this, so this is official. We paid a margin of LIBOR plus 285 basis points. So we paid up like 50-60 basis points on that financing for that particular ship. However, when the COVID crisis hit, long-term interest rates in the world plummeted. And in order to get a good all-in cost of capital on that financing, we also secured it entirely with interest rate swap, 100% hedging, at 45 basis points. So our all-in cost of funding for Flex Volunteer was 3.3%. And then interest rates has been picking up as the world has become more normal. So once the interest rate was picking up, and we had a period here, I believe, in probably around April or something, interest rates were higher. And that's what we've done at 45 basis points was suddenly more like 95 basis points. And that 50 basis point we paid up on the financing, we were in the money on the swap. So we decided to liquidate one of our swaps, which was then very much in the money. So I believe somewhere around $1.5 million that swap was in the money. And then we used that proceed, $1.5 million, to reduce the interest rate on two other swaps. So it's a bit technical, but I think it also demonstrates how we are thinking about risk. So that's why we kind of did it, because we hedged it, and then the trade we have done kind of unwinded. And then, but we are pragmatic to this. So we have finance, we have a hedging ratio on our bank financings of I believe close to 67%, around about 2/3 of our floating interest rates we have hedged. We have two ships, Flex Endeavor and Enterprise, which we announced in April 2019, I believe, we did with Hyundai Glovis, where the bareboat rate or the higher is fixed for 10 years. So those are fixed in terms of interest rate exposure. And then we have fixed some of our bank financing about as well. And then we have some leases which are floating. So it really, really depends. It doesn't really mean anything about how we are viewing the future. But we felt when 5-year swap was going from 45 basis points to close to 1%, we took some money off the table.
Certainly, very, very detailed response. That'll be useful for folks who are looking at the weeds of the swaps, and obviously long-term balancing will be beneficial for you. It just I know sometimes you see these transactions and you know investors might think, well, what's going on here? So I appreciate your time and effort to dive into that. As we wrap up today, I want to give you a quick moment to talk about Flex LNG as opposed to other LNG shipping focused stocks on the market. Why should investors consider investing in Flex LNG as opposed to a different company?
I think if you first start with the industry, so if you are investing in shipping, and generally in my experience as well, it's much better to be in a shipping segment where you have a lot of growth, and a lot of shipping segments are mature, while LNG, last year, LNG exports were like 370 million tons. And depending on what analyst you are believing in 2040, we will have somewhere like exports of 650 to 700 million tons. So you have a market that is growing very steadily. And also this year, we expect growth to be very strong. So once you have a market that is growing a lot, in shipping, you will always have over-optimism where people are investing too many ships. But if you have a market that is growing, at least once you are being hurt that there are too many ships in the market, you don't really need to go through a lot of scrapping to rebalance it. The growth will take care of that. So I think that is one of the good things by investing in a shipping market that is growing, that the growth will take care of overcapacity. Mm. And then I think another factor which we really like is the fact that a lot of the ships in the industry are very inefficient. So we do think scrapping will actually go up a lot because of these 200 steamships. That's another reason. Mm. So that's more like shipping and sector. And then if you look into like company specifics, I think we are As I mentioned, if you look at replacement CapEx, we are very attractive compared to buying buying new ships and kind of setting up a company. And then I think we're very transparent on everything. Our balance sheet is very, you know, easy to comprehend. Basically, our balance sheet is like this: 13 ships, $2.4 billion invested. Book value maybe now 2.3 or something. $140 million of cash on our assets side, so like $2.5 billion or so. And then equity liabilities, $1.65 billion of long-term debt and $860 million of equity. And that's our balance sheet. It's very easy to comprehend. There's nothing magic about it. There's no goodwill. There's no book, as you know, all the ships are ordered at the low point of the cycle, and that's not really being at a higher level than the replacement CapEx. So, and then I think if you look at the governance issue, and the governance is very important when investing in shipping, because there are a lot of people with the wrong incentives. They might set up a shipping company where they own, you know, a slice of the equity, a very limited slice, but where the management really have incentives to generate transactions or other things in order to skim fees. We are not like that. You know, we are sitting together with shareholders. Our biggest shareholder owns 46% of the company. He has the best track record of any shipping investors around. Just look at Frontline, paid more than $6 billion of dividends since listed in New York Stock Exchange. SFL paid well ahead of $2 billion of dividends. Golden Oceans just hiked their dividend to 25 cents. So if you look at the history of treating shareholders well and being transparent and being shareholder friendly in terms of focusing on dividends rather than, you know, just ordering more ships in order to build big shipping companies, I think we have a good track record. So I think those are the most important attributes.
Certainly comprehensive sales pitch, Øystein, and I think the one underpinning factor that I fully agree with is corporate governance. It is vastly important in shipping that we have improved governance. We've seen that across the last decade in this space, but it's good to see Flex at the forefront in your niche, in your LNG shipping trade in particular, and we hope more companies will model themselves in a similar fashion. So thanks again for joining us, Øystein. I appreciate your insights on the LNG markets.
Thank you, Jay. And I hope to be back for the fifth round soon. And hopefully this could be, I would suggest maybe in September. I'm pretty bullish about the rate environment and the mood then.
Well, the year-over-year returns from last summer when we talked are almost a four-bagger, right, from $4. So I don't know if we can get to 64. I don't know if we can outdo that performance, but we'll see what we see. Thanks, Øystein.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, everybody.
This includes another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. This is recorded on the morning of 10 June 2021 at about 10 a.m. Eastern Time. As a reminder, nothing on the call today constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations in any form. I have a long position in Flex LNG. If you're listening to this recording at a later date, please look at the latest disclosures as of that report.